Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking through most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two interviews up today, both on the subject of finance. First, the meltdown and the post-meltdown evolution, and then second, the financial regulation bill that the president signed into law just a day or two ago. First, actually a rerun of an interview which was first broadcast in March with Eve Smith, who is the keeper of the Naked Capitalism blog and author of the book Econ, which came out a few months ago. My original guest scheduled in that time slot had something of an emergency and had to cancel, so a last-minute substitution from the archives. And then at the bottom of the hour, a chat with Rob Weissman, who is the president of Public Citizen, who's been on this show several times before. He will be talking about the financial regulation, the so-called Dodd-Frank bill. What's in it, what's not in it, how good, how bad. Evaluation of what that will mean to finance and to us. Just a couple of comments on the Shirley Sherrod affair. I guess I throw my two cents on, along with everyone else. I just thought it was very interesting that in the full talk, which I was looking at on the web the other day, she had been talking about the kind of history of racialization in the United States, and she was talking about how both white and black were indentured servants in the early colonial days, and the masters were the ones who invented the racialization, the racial distinction, encouraged that distinction in the interest of rivalry and division to cement their rule. And it was very interesting that her very thoughtful her very thoughtful remarks, which are the kinds of things we should be talking about more than we are, and we talk about them hardly at all, we should be talking about them a lot more. Her remarks were turned by a vile right-wing hack into a revolting cliche of just the opposite of what the spirit of Shirley Sherrod's full speech was about. It's too bad that got lost, and I hope that people will take this occasion to watch her remarks and listen to them and think about them and talk about them, because God knows we need it. Certainly, that's the kind of thing we've talked about on this radio station and on this show. I've had people like David Roediger on to talk about the history of racialization in the U.S., and, of course, Barbara Fields had a very fine piece on this in New Left Review many, many years ago, 20, 25 years ago, a very important essay that goes into the history of the invention of race in the U.S. context. We need to have a broader conversation than that, not just on community radio stations and left-wing quasi-academic journals, but something that should be injected into our broader public discourse, and not the poison that Andrew Breitbart injects into our public discourse. All right, now some words in the economic news. Further signs of slowdown. Housing starts are off. Prices seem to be drifting lower in housing, and that's important because the housing market has properties of leading the rest of the economy, both up and down. And also, we saw that first-time applications for unemployment insurance were up last week. There may be some seasonal adjustment issues. It was a fairly big rise, but in any case, the signs that the labor market is stalling or even deteriorating mount with each passing week, and this is not good news at all. Yet against this background, we're hearing louder calls for a global tightening of economic policy. The calls are loudest in Europe, but you hear them here, too. There's an immense worry around about mounting debt, and it was a struggle just to get Congress to pass an extension of unemployment benefits. It took several tries to get that through, and any more stimulus right now looks impossible. What is the problem? The public is very confused on the debt crisis, on debt issues, as any review of the polling evidence would reveal. Debt and deficits are rarely volunteered as a leading problem, but people will express appropriate concern if they're asked specifically about them. But what about debt and deficits worry people exactly? There's certainly a moral disapproval of debt, a disapproval that doesn't always extend to their own private affairs, and it's a prominent symbol of economic ills. Yet when asked specifically if they approve of cutting Social Security or Medicare to balance Washington's books, they do not. In fact, respondents tell Kaiser pollsters that they'd rather increase taxes on the rich to pay for Medicare than put the squeeze on benefits. And support for Social Security is both broad and deep. But when folks like Obama advisor David Axelrod say the administration has to respond to people's concerns about debt and deficits, he may not mean the broad population. He may mean people like attendees of the Aspen Ideas Festival, a joint venture of the Aspen Institute and Atlantic Monthly magazine, where, as Lloyd Grove reported the other day in the Daily Beast, there was much worry about all that red ink in Washington. The odious historian Neil Ferguson complained that Obama was turning the USA into a European-style welfare state. If only he were. He further worried that by extending unemployment benefits, the government is encouraging laziness. If there were any justice in this world, Ferguson would be forced to live on the $307 a week. That's the size of the average benefit check. But instead, Ferguson can feed his paymasters with fantasies of working-class leisure. Paymasters like Mort Zuckerman, who moaned in Aspen that Obama's economic policies are so hostile to business that they're turning the U.S. into a second-rate power. Any diminution of U.S. power would be deeply welcome, but it is delusional to call Obama and company hostile to business, and weird to indict the stimulus program, which could well have saved us from economic collapse, for doing a sin. But you have to wonder, what is driving this lunacy? In the European case, there's a materialist rationality. The old world elite would like to crack what remains of working class strength and pare back the welfare state, and the current crisis offers a lovely pretext for pursuing that agenda. In the U.S., however, the working class is powerless and the welfare state virtually non-existent. Rational reasons for debt phobia don't spring immediately to mind. It may be wrong to look at purely rational reasons, however. Anxiety about debt may be a displacement of an anxiety about the underlying health of the U.S. economy. If we are indeed facing unprecedented decades of stagnation, as elite economists like Robert Gordon and the Congressional Budget Office both predict, it might require a serious rethink of the entire U.S. economic model. Since that sort of thing is essentially unthinkable in orthodox circles, anxiety collects around the symbol of the problem, indebtedness, especially to China, the rising rival, rather than around the problem itself. Perhaps that's too psychological. Maybe there really are some more vulgar materialist explanations. Some elite pundits think that the economy has survived its brush with death and it's time for a return to normalcy. Related to that is the perpetual fear that deficits will lead to inflation. That seems far-fetched with the economy as deeply weak as it is. But if you think that the weakness is merely transient, then there's no real reason to fear deflation, the opposite peril. Still, despite the far-fetchedness of this fantasy, the fear has some powerful adherents. And then there's the fear that Greece is our future, a serious funding crisis in which lenders refuse to buy any more U.S. bonds. There's not even the remotest sign of that. Evidence is that countries that don't face sovereign debt crises until their debt-to-GDP ratios break 100%, ours is around 65%. On the eve of its crisis, Greece's ratio was 125%. Even in the Congressional Budget Office's hysterical predictions, the U.S. won't cross that 100 threshold until 2074. Italy's ratio is well over 100% today, and Japan's is approaching 200%, yet neither country is circling the drain. It's long been my position that over the long term, deficits do matter. Building up large stocks of debt means paying rich people lots of interest instead of taxing them to fund more noble pursuits. For the next few years, though, the economy needs the stimulus of a deficit. And over the longer term, we desperately need a new economic model, a more equitable distribution of income so that people aren't forced to borrow to stay afloat, and a more ecologically sustainable way of living. Taxing and spending are the only roads to that better future. Both the short and long-term perspectives make austerity the enemy of human progress. Okay, let's take a little musical break. We'll be back to talk finance.
Crawling, crawling, crawling.
Well, maybe we are crawling from the wreckage of that financial crisis. But that was Dave Edmunds with his band from the, I guess, the late 70s with that great old song. And as I said earlier, my guest who is scheduled for this slot had a bit of a health emergency, so had to cancel. And so I have reached into the archives at the last minute and pulled out this. This is Eve Smith, who is a money manager, a Wall Street money manager, who keeps the Naked Capitalism blog and had a book that came out a couple of months ago called Econ, about how the economics profession contributed to the financial crisis. So let's switch over to the original introduction, and then we'll hear the interview with Eve Smith from last March. My first guest is Eve Smith, not her real name. Smith is an investment advisor, keeper of the Naked Capitalism blog, and author of the new book, Econ, How Unenlightened Self-Interest Undermined Democracy and Corrupted Capitalism. I think the last two words of the subtitle are redundant, but that's just me. I've been arguing lately that we've learned nothing from this financial crisis. Smith argues persuasively that things have actually gotten worse. Eve Smith. Welcome, Eve Smith. In the standard bill of indictment for the creators of the credit crisis, the financial crisis, and the subsequent recession includes, you know, a lot of people on Wall Street, human greed and such, but you have a lot of blame available for economists or the economics profession. What is the contribution of economics to the debacle?
Economists created a series that led to financial deregulation. That in turn unleashed predatory impulses that had previously been held in check. The book, among other things, traces not only the evolution of the economic theory, which goes back to the 1940s and 50s, then the regulatory changes that started in the 70s, and the rise of increasingly predatory behavior. And that's really much more at the high end of the financial system. I mean, you know, many members of your audience, you know, no doubt have even some personal experience, as well as have read the many accounts of, you know, how credit card practices in the credit card industry and in mortgages have become predatory towards customers. Well, this was replicated actually preceded by a rise in predatory behavior towards at the very high end of Wall Street in terms of increasingly treating their customers as more like professional counterparties than ongoing relationships.
Well, the standard story of orthodox economics is that we're all selfish actors, but when we all get together in rational markets, the market somehow disciplines that selfishness. But why do the theorists have no room for the idea that if markets are unregulated, individual actors will behave as selfishly as possible, even damaging their own institutions, much less the larger system?
Well, we have one set of stories, which is mainstream economics, and you set forth that story, which is, you know, which is essentially that markets, you know, that markets are competitive, and that we can rely, as you said, that we can rely on markets to discipline bad behavior. The problem is that there are other theories that are what I would almost call accepted heresies that in fact fundamentally contradict. The heresies fundamentally contradict the mainstream story. The idea, for example, of information asymmetry, the notion if you believe that one party, see the used car problem, if one party knows more than the other, it can take advantage of the other party. And their ability to act against it is, to counter it's very limited. But more important, they completely ignore the vast majority of the real business world. I mean, the things that people are taught in business schools about how to help companies make money is all about creating market inefficiencies. It's all about things like economy. You know, the mainstream theory allows not an iota for the way that economic actors accumulate power and gain leverage through things like economies of scale, through things like creating customer loyalty, whether it's good or bad. You know, there was an early stage in the computer business where nobody would buy anything other than IBM, even though it was very clear that clone PCs were a much better buy. You know, there are reasons that people will do things that look from an economic perspective quite foolish. And it's a different way, different ways that, you know, companies have succeeded in gaining advantage, and those ways often, you know, sometimes they're quite beneficial. You know, that process also leads to, you know, bona fide differentiation, like the iPod. But in fact, you know, the iPod when it came out was basically a monopoly. You know, and economic theory is very dismissive of, you know, they're treated like a special case and not very interesting.
Well, let's talk about a specific example relevant to this. You say, you talk about information asymmetries. In classical or neoclassical theory, all participants are supposed to be equally well-informed, but in fact, financiers, when they create derivatives, try to make them as opaque as possible. So tell us about the uphill battle that a buyer of a derivative faces in trying to understand it.
Well, no, in fact, sometimes the contracts are beyond the understanding of a normal person, and this is, they'll have very complicated formulas when peculiarly people will buy these derivatives even when the formulas are beyond their understanding. I mean, there's a classic example in the book where you look at the formula and it looks rather daunting, and no matter what set of numbers you put in, the result is zero. And this is an example from a real derivatives contract that somebody bought. This is not, you know, somebody just making up a cute story. I mean, that's the kind of chicanery that went on. And then if you buy one of these derivatives, unlike some other, there are some other products that are traded over the counter where they're still traded sufficiently frequently that you can call several dealers or see the price on Bloomberg, you know, even though it's an over-the-counter market. You know, the same way, you know, houses in a certain neighborhood. You know, you can look, even though houses don't, you know, trade every 3 minutes, you can have a good idea of what a fair price for a house is. You can have a fair idea what the prices for a lot of over-the-counter instruments are. For the vast majority of derivatives, the ones that aren't traded on exchanges, that's just not the case. You've got something very customized. You can, you know, your dealer can give you a price on it. It might even be hard for another dealer to give you a price on it because they priced it with a particular hedging strategy in mind. You can't do these derivatives unless you figured out how you're going to hedge your exposure. So, and a lot of customers are afraid, for reasons that aren't very good, to call up another dealer to get a price, or they just might not be important enough for a dealer to give them a quote. You know, if you're, let's say a mid-sized corporation, you call somebody else up. Why are they going to bother giving you a price if you're not a customer? They know you're just fishing. So you're really very hostage to the person who sold you that derivative in the first place.
We should underscore the point. The bankers like these things to be opaque, right? Because they can make more money on them.
Right, because you can't tell. Again, unlike, you know, let's say you buy a bond. You know, you call, even when you buy a bond, if you bought the bond at, you know, 98 cents on the dollar, you'll know that 97.5 cents on the dollar is a better price. It's very clear for you how you compare prices. With derivatives, the extra price is loaded in through, the margin is loaded in through things like, you know, volatility assumptions or being sold the G, you know, you have X, we can give you Y, and Y might have a very important feature stripped out that's really valuable that you as a customer won't understand. Like you might give up, you know, the option to say refinance in 10 years, and you have no idea what that option's worth, and you won't be attentive to the fact that was omitted in the version 2 you were persuaded to buy. And that really had a lot of value. You know, there are all kinds of ways that they can load margin in that most customers won't understand.
Now, the rating agencies rated a lot of this stuff in many instances, and a lot of the buyers were supposedly very sophisticated people. What happened?
Well, the rating agencies didn't directly rate derivatives, but they would oftentimes rate products that had derivatives loaded into them. And yes, the rating agencies, you know, wouldn't have been. They're not supposed to regulate. You know, their job isn't to regulate price. Their job is just to regulate credit quality. And yet, many times, for very complicated products, people were using rating agency models, which were never intended to be used for pricing purposes to price these things. So that was one way that things really got out of hand. And then, in terms of sophistication, you know, there were some products that frankly, an incredibly small number of people understand. For example, collateralized debt obligations, which really played a very, very important role in the crisis. There were probably only 200 to 300 people in the world who really understand these things, and maybe another 700 that were in the room, you know, either rating agencies or lawyers that were involved in documenting these deals that, you know, understand a lot of the features, but that doesn't mean they're competent to price them. You know, when you've got that kind of expertise concentrated in a very few people in a product that's widely peddled, that's a prescription for people being abused.
I'm speaking with Eve Smith, who is the keeper of the Naked Capitalism blog and also the author of Econed, just out from Palgrave Macmillan. Let's talk a little bit about the psychology of Wall Street then. You talk about, for example, Robert Shiller, who was advising the New York Fed, had some reservations about what was going on with the housing bubble and the associated financial products, but he swallowed them or softened his objections. Wall Street is not really a place that rewards critical thinking or people who don't go along, is it?
No, I mean, absolutely not. And, you know, nobody on Wall Street got rewarded for making markets more efficient or transparent. That's the way of low profits. You know, people are celebrated for coming up with either new products or new ways to sell old products that have high margins. So the whole direction of, and on the one hand, you know, again, back to the iPod example, there's nothing wrong with launching a new product and collecting a lot of margin for the time before people, you know, imitate it. You know, in theory, there's nothing wrong with that. But in practice, what happened on Wall Street is that, you know, I was in the industry as a young person in the early 1980s. And, you know, people always went to Wall Street to make money. I mean, that was the whole point of the exercise. Nobody was under any illusions as to what the objectives were. But Wall Street knew its place then. I mean, people understood that ultimately finance served industry, that the customer had to feel that they were getting a reasonable deal, that, yeah, you might take some extra margin now and again, but you didn't kill the goose that laid the golden egg. Well, as the industry became increasingly deregulated, the footing went from seeing customers as relationships that were to be nurtured to seeing a customer as a trade. There were a whole bunch of factors that eroded, both on the customer side and on the Wall Street side, that eroded customer loyalty, and there were also deregulation. Also, the most important aspect was that it led to the end of the partnership model. And in partnerships, if a firm screwed up, the partners could lose all their money, not just the money they had in the firm, but all their personal money. There was unlimited liability. And that was a really huge check when you had the top people at the firm at the risk of losing everything they had ever made. And when that check on behavior went, that was the real turbocharger to the end of that sort of balance between the predatory, because there had always been predatory impulses, between the predatory impulses taking control versus the, you know, gee, this is a long-term franchise, you know, gee, we have to be really careful about how we manage things.
You've just described a whole series of real-world features of life on Wall Street that most economists, you know, out at the free market Vatican in Chicago have no inkling of or do not take on board when they're writing their pretty little theories. How can there be such a disparity between theory and actual practice?
Well, you can be either one. You can be cynical about it and say that the Chicago School and its followers represents an ideology, and to a fair degree, it is an ideology. You know that they believe in notions of freedom that are carried to an extreme in the economic realm. You know that there's a belief that the only source, ultimately, you know, I mean, the more extreme and simplified version of it is libertarianism. That ultimately, the only source of coercion can come from the government, which ignores the fact that any market actor that has a lot of power is also coercive. You know, if you're in a small town and Walmart's the biggest employer and Walmart's, you know, you've lost your job at the local hardware store, you have to work, you know, you have no choice. It's either work for Walmart or starve. The notion that economic actors don't have a lot of power, you know, is a bit naive. But the second thing is that the economics discipline has and this is a methodological choice that I discuss in the book, that economics went in a very self-conscious way to try to make itself more scientific. Now, on the one hand, how can you be opposed to that impulse? But in practical terms, it led them to adopt mathematics, and it's very specific types of mathematical procedures. It's a proof-like formalization of a lot of arguments. And the problem is that omits a lot of types of empirical research, including ones that will embrace qualitative data. It forces what I call drunk under the streetlight behavior of looking only where they can get, either they can construct tidy theories or get very tidy data sets. And those stories like the one I told about behavior, those don't fit very neatly into proof type stories. It almost forces them to look at the world in a very blinkered fashion.
Okay, so we are here. We are the crisis, at least the worst of it, seems to be fading. The economy is stabilizing, if not recovering, and it seems like not all that much has changed. Do you think that thinking or practice has really changed substantially as a result of this wrenching disaster?
Actually, I think it's gotten worse, to be perfectly honest. That we went into the crisis with at least the belief that certain firms wouldn't be rescued. You know, the Wall Street firms that were formerly investment banks on paper had no reason to think they would be bailed out. Now we saw that, you know, effectively Bear Stearns and Lehman weren't, Lehman was allowed to collapse, but Bear Stearns and Merrill were subsidized marriages. I mean, they both got backstops for their acquirers, and not all the employees. In fact, in the case of Merrill, a lot of the employees still had jobs. And I think even in the case of Bear, something like 40 or 50% of the employees still wound up having jobs. And the top executives, no one's gone to jail. No one's even been investigated. A few guys have been hauled up before Congress and asked some embarrassing questions. An expert on corporate governance, Lucian Bebchuk, ran the math and said basically, you know, look at the top guys at these firms. Even though the firms, you know, failed underneath them, they still got tremendous amounts of money. Now, yeah, they would have been richer if the firms hadn't failed. But, you know, by any reasonable standard, these guys are still very rich. So here and now, everybody sees that these firms were backstopped in a very aggressive way. And so now, the whole notion that this is a heads I win, tails you lose game looks to be institutionalized. This is actually worse than what we had before the crisis.
What would be a better way of reimagining the financial system then?
Well, unfortunately, it's going to take a lot more political will, and the window we had to exercise some will, which was right at the beginning of the Obama administration, that opportunity was missed. Unfortunately, you're going to have to do either one, it's actually probably both of two things. One is that there are ways that these firms are very deeply enmeshed. That's why we now have this de facto no more Lehman's policy, that the big firms that are at the heart of the capital markets business, which means the international global debt trading infrastructure, are all connected through a funding market called repos, repurchase agreements. That's a big element of the shadow banking system that isn't much talked about, but they lend and borrow from each other on a day-to-day basis in a very significant way. The second is the more famous credit default swaps market. They are also very much exposed to each other through credit default swaps, and unless the way those markets work are very much restructured, any one firm going down, or even if you attempt to resolve it, I don't see how they can possibly be resolved in a neat way unless there are big efforts to reduce how much they're exposed to each other on a day-to-day basis. The second is the only realistic way to end this backstopping notion is to regulate much more aggressively and to identify what the core really valuable to society activities are and regulate those like utilities, and permit firms that are regulated that way only to extend credit to people outside those types of activities in very limited ways. You know, so for example, if you're a private equity firm and you want to borrow a lot of money to finance your deal, guess what? You can't borrow that from one of these regulated firms. Maybe you'll have to go to another hedge fund that set up a very special fund to invest in risky, you know, corporate acquisitions, but you won't be able to finance your risky deal from a firm that's got a government backstop.
Now, the standard response to this, of course, would be we can't do it, it's too late, it's too complex, and would stifle innovations that have a great payoff. What do you say to those standard defenses?
Well, the innovation argument is grossly oversold, and I'm with Paul Volcker on that one, who thinks the last innovation that was socially valuable was the ATM machine. What is labeled as innovation has almost entirely been to create additional fees for Wall Street. I mean, if you just look at the data, the growth of the financial services, financial services used to account for less than 10% of Standard & Poor's earnings. Right before the eve of the crisis, financial services accounted for 40% of S&P earnings. This is not a healthy profile for a society. This is a predatory profile. You know, there's no evidence that that these supposed innovations deliver real benefit to the real economy, that they can't largely be achieved through much simpler products that are traded in a much simpler way.
That was Eve Smith, Y-V-E-S Smith, not her real name.
Yes, and that was Eve Smith, and that was my outro to the Eve Smith interview, first broadcast on the show back in March. And Eve Smith is the author of Econ, which came out from Palgrave Macmillan back in March, I believe, and keeper of the Naked Capitalism blog. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk financial regulation with Rob Weissman.
WBI, Zapama, WBI, Hebu, and WBI, Zap Mama, with Zap Mama.
And this is WBAI, not only at 99.5 in your FM dial in New York, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit that website, you can not only listen to all these shows on archive, but you can also send some money our way. God knows we need it. Press that donate button and support this experiment in community broadcasting so we can carry on for another half century. Okay, now time for the musical break, and then Rob Weissman. And that was some of the Marxist Brit indie pop band McCarthy from about 15 years ago, I think. And I think they're poking fun at people who are just too pure even to use a bank. But that's not us. And now joined the line by Rob Weissman, who's the president of Public Citizen, based in Washington, D.C., and occasional guest in this program, mostly to talk about Wall Street. Welcome, Rob.
Hey, Doug. Great to be with you.
It's good to have you. Thanks for stopping by. So the president signed this massive piece of legislation. It is now law. Have you been staying up nights reading all 2,300 pages of Dodd-Frank?
I haven't got through the whole thing yet.
Okay. All right. But let's talk about what exactly it does. I mean, is this as monumental as what we saw in the 1930s with Glass-Steagall and the creation of the SEC and the FDIC and all that, or is this something smaller in scale, although it's bigger in volume?
Not as monumental is the easy answer. I think the next a little bit longer version is the bill does some really good and important things. We were very strongly supportive of it. And it does very few things that are bad, which is a key test for legislation in Washington. But it doesn't take on the most fundamental issues that it should have. It doesn't deal in important ways with the structure of the financial sector, with the big banks and Wall Street firms. And it would not have prevented the crisis that took place in September 2008 had it been in place, and it won't stop the next one either.
Well, let's talk about what is in it. What are the major provisions of this gigantic legislative volume?
Well, there really is an enormous amount in it. I think the most positive piece in it is the creation of this new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that is going to have pretty wide-ranging authority to crack down on abusive, predatory, and deceptive credit, forms of credit, whether it's home mortgages, college loans, credit card terms.
The original administration proposal was for an independent body. Now, this is somehow institutionally part of the Fed. How independent is it, or how much subordinated to the Fed is it? Because, you know, the Fed is not known for its tenderness towards consumers.
That's correct. It was a strange kind of compromise. It is located within the Fed, but it is, except for that statement of fact, sort of on the organizational chart, it really is quite independent in all structural ways that matter. So the new head of the new agency will be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, not appointed by the Fed. They don't answer to the Fed in any way that's direct. We have to be a little bit worried about how it plays out over time. Even to its own organizational chart and embedded within the Federal Reserve was obviously intended as a compromise to the big bank and Wall Street interests. So that's worrisome. But it didn't mollify them very much. And some of them critically said this is really nothing more than a rental agreement, which is to say they're renting space in the Fed. Figuratively, I think that's mostly true.
But what about how's it going to be funded? Is it going to be well funded, or is it going to have to beg for dimes?
No, it's going to have a substantial budget, which I think will be on the order of $500 million annually, and it's structured as a percentage of some source of funding at the Fed. So it should have, without having to go through an appropriations fight every year, quite a bit of money to do the work it's going to have in front of it.
And what is its beat exactly?
Well, the beat is all consumer financial products with some specified exemptions, the most prominent of which is auto dealers lobbied their way out of coverage altogether. But it has authority over banks and credit unions and others, home mortgage lenders and originators. It'll have also payday lenders, for example, will also have authority over retail credit providers if they are effectively in the business of providing credit rather than really legitimate retail.
And will it have any power to cap the usurious rates that the likes of payday lenders charge, or is it just going to look at the terms a little more carefully?
It'll be more on the terms around issues of deceit, sort of abuse in terms of process and tricking people rather than on the absolute interest rate.
And what about the fees and gimmickries that credit card companies have imposed?
Except that they're gimmicks and not disclosed and people don't understand what they are, either because you didn't know you were paying the fee, or you didn't understand you were going to be required to pay fees, or you don't understand, or possibly you don't understand how much fees are, contextually don't understand how much they are. All those things are potentially in the ambit of the new agency.
And, of course, there's a big fight over who will the first head of this thing be, partly for a hint of how it's going to operate, but also, I guess, for setting a precedent for the future. A lot of people would like to see Elizabeth Warren, who is a pretty wonderful person, nominated. I would fall over if she were actually nominated. What's your guess on that?
Who knows how it's going to turn out? We're certainly pushing really hard for, as are lots of organizations in Washington and around the country. And I wouldn't want to bet against her. You know, it's clear that she's in her role as head of the Congressional Oversight Panel, she has antagonized people at the White House and especially at Treasury and criticizing the conduct of the bailout and really everything that this administration, not just their past administration, has done in responding to the financial crash. So they don't like her very much, and that's going to be the big problem that she's going to face in terms of winning the nomination. On the other hand, the building pressure for her means that if they pick somebody else, they're really making a statement that they may not want to be making.
Okay, what about other provisions of the bill? Great controversy over the so-called Volcker Rule. How much of that survived into the final legislation?
It's going to be hard to know exactly. The Volcker Rule was intended to try to modernize Glass-Steagall, which it's structurally separated commercial banks, the kind that where we have checking accounts from investment banks, meaning with Goldman Sachs. But as that division was eviscerated over time and then eliminated altogether in 1999, it's not so easy to rebuild that divide. I mean, they both take on functions now that are more engaged in the casino economy than either were in the 1970s. So the Volcker Rule said, well, look, commercial banks that are, particularly banks that are getting backstopped by federal insurance, shouldn't be engaged in, you shouldn't be permitted to bet in stock market and other bond and equity markets, derivative markets, with a backstop of this federal insurance. So he was and that was encapsulated in this idea that banks shouldn't be engaged in proprietary trading. That ban is in the bill, but then there are other ways around, all kinds of complicated ways around it, and one of them is, well, can the banks then own hedge funds, which exist to do exactly that? And they got a lot more space to own hedge funds for a longer period of time and a bigger chunk of hedge funds that had been, than it seemed was going to be the case until the final bill was finished.
Yeah, the idea was that they were supposed to put a firewall between speculating on their own account and a federal insurance guarantee. But it seems like the clever minds, the bankers and the lawyers, have been already trying to figure out ways around that. How porous is that that firewall?
Well, I think it's worrisome. The big loophole that they got, that they were able to achieve in the final hours of negotiation between in the conference committee to reconcile the House and Senate versions, the big thing that they got added was that the banks were able to spend, to allocate more of their money to owning hedge funds. So that's going to be, at least at first blush, is going to be the first way to get around this restriction, and we'll have to see how it plays out. One of the worries about on this piece, and really throughout the whole bill, and sort of encapsulating this idea that you, this fact that you point out, it's a 2,300-page bill, the more complicated things are, the more reason there is to assume that the banks are going to be able to evade the complicated rules. If you just have clean and simple rules, then maybe they can be enforced with goodwill. But if they're really complicated, as they are in this case and throughout the bill, then you just have to assume that the banks are going to figure out some way to game the system. So I think there are a lot of interesting pieces in the bill, a lot of things that sort of faint in the right direction, which have been forced in a certain way, or if you were to sort of discern the actual intent, you might feel very good about it. But then you look at how complicated the statute is and know that it's going to become even more complicated as there's follow-on rulemaking and dozens of studies that are required with follow-on rules from those. You just have to assume that the banks are going to be able to work a way around what comes out of it.
And another complicated issue, there was a push to push derivatives trading onto exchanges, that is, to limit the degree to which banks could invent custom-made derivatives for their clients, which can get very obscure, complicated, fee-laden, but also very dangerous, as we found out in recent years. An attempt to put those onto standardized exchanges and trade them that way, how much of that survived?
Well, that's one that we think was a big win. I mean, I don't want to overstate it because that became the that was a radical position in the context at the beginning of the debate over Wall Street reform, and still seemed like the outlier of what was possible until strange developments made things that were more aggressive possible.
Yeah, Blanche Lincoln's primary challenge. Right.
So exchange trading is a very positive thing. It makes it transparent. We can figure out who owes what to whom, and requires, hypothetically at least, proper posting of capital to make sure that nobody is making bets that they're not ultimately able to pay for. And so it's a good thing. Way more was needed. But this good thing of required exchange and trading and clearing and use of clearing houses did survive pretty well. So we actually feel that's one of the big wins in the bill. Again, without trying to overstate the importance of it, but it's pretty significant, and I think we did well on that point.
I'm speaking with Rob Weissman, who is the president of Public Citizen in Washington, D.C. Now, despite the length of this bill, over 2,000 pages, and it's amazing how much longer legislation is now than it used to be. Glass-Steagall was only about 30 pages or something, I think. they have to write regulations to put even more flesh on these already fleshy bones. What's this regulatory process going to look like, or rulemaking process going to look like in the coming months?
Well, not months, years. It's going to be very messy, and you really can't imagine a scenario where the banks and the finance sector don't dominate the rulemaking process. There's no possibility of all the public interest groups and all the sort of public interest-minded persons with some expertise combined coming anywhere near the resources and the talent that the banks, the financial sector are going to deploy in dealing with rulemaking. So for people in our shoes, public citizen and others like us, we're going to have to focus in on a handful of things that we think are crucially important, and then really try to wage the fight, which, depending on the rules, will occur over a course of months, or as I mentioned, some of these rules are actually probably not going to take place, or will sort of be unraveled over the course of up to 12 years.
Yeah, and I think most major provisions of the bill are not scheduled to take effect for, 3, 4, 5 years, right?
Yeah, it varies from portion to the bill to portion of the bill. I mean, the bill requires literally dozens of studies, and some of those studies are just for the purpose of someone want to study so they could at least say they were trying to do something on some issues. Some of the provisions of the bill require that after a study, action be taken. For example, a significant piece in the bill has to do with the credit rating companies, credit rating agencies that were so important to leading up to the crash by giving inflated ratings to poor quality bonds. They did that in significant part because they had these fundamental conflict of interest where they were paid by the issuers of those bonds, and they wanted to make sure that they kept getting business, so they gave the bonds high ratings. Al Franken had a provision passed in the Senate that would say, okay, when you go to have your bond rated, it'll be randomly assigned. You're going to pay as the bond issuer, but it'll be which of the certified issuers does the rating for your bond will be randomly assigned to you. That was actually quite a good idea, passed the Senate. In the final bill, though, it's watered down, so there is a study required, and that becomes the rule unless the study suggests something else that might also do the job, as to be determined by the SEC.
And, of course, that process of study will be heavily influenced by banks and their lobbyists.
Exactly right.
I think I saw one story that said that it creates 180 studies or something like that, which is just remarkable. That's one every 10 pages or so.
It's hard to keep up. I think the maybe 180 regulations or rulemakings are required. Although the Chamber of Commerce has 350 rulemakings, I think the studies may be more like 60. But I haven't done my count myself.
So who exactly is going to do all this rulemaking?
Well, this covers the whole terrain of the alphabet soup agencies that are involved in financial regulation. So, a lot of it's going to be by the Federal Reserve. Some of it will be by the Comptroller of the Currency. Some of it will be by the FDIC. Some of it will be by the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Some of it will be by the Securities Exchange Commission. Some of it will be by the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Which brings up another point. Henry Paulson had proposed streamlining the whole system of financial regulation to create a single super regulatory agency. Did not survive at all. We still have the alphabet soup, a lot of division of responsibilities. It allows finance types to shop for friendly regulatory environments. Not much done in that regard, was there?
No, they are going to close down probably the worst and most captured of the agencies, which is the Office of Thrift Supervision, and merge that into the Comptroller of the Currency, I believe.
But other than that, we still have an extremely divided...
Other than that, everybody else survived. And that is partially because the bureaucracies are able to fight for themselves, but even more importantly, because different committees in Congress have jurisdiction over different agencies, and they didn't want to lose the authority that they had by virtue of this oversight and authorization jurisdiction. So they wanted to protect and keep in place their own agencies.
And they did create some sort of big chat shop where all these guys are supposed to get together and talk things over and keep an eye on how all the pieces fit together, right?
Yeah, there's going to be a Council on Systemic Risk created, which is, as you say, a talk shop. I mean, some people think this is a very exciting development and they'll be able to foresee all kinds of things. I think it's very inconsequential. We did have an agency already in place that has authority for systemic oversight. It's called the Federal Reserve, and it failed utterly, and I don't think getting a lot more people in the room is likely to change that result.
And the insurance industry will not have any federal regulation or still remain regulated by the states. That's true?
Yes. There was proposed an Office of National Insurance, but it would have had a pretty light touch over over the state-based regulation. I'm not sure how that ultimately turned out. There was one issue of concern about the ability of the federal regulator to preempt state regulation to comply with international trade rules, which was very worrisome. And I have to concede I don't know what the final result was.
So you said that as these rules are written in the coming months and years, that you're going to have to pick your fights. Any sense of what public citizens' priorities will be?
We're going to focus on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, certainly. I think the one that I mentioned about the credit rating company is one where it's very focused and could be really powerful. We very much emphasized both the Volcker rule and trying to break up the banks. So we will look closely at the provisions that address Volcker rule implementation and some of the things that conceivably could limit the size of the big banks and see if we think there's real opportunity there to make a difference or whether we know anyway that we have to go back to Congress on that, but there may be things to do that are creative and interesting within the framework of this bill. We just have to check.
And there wasn't any movement on the too big to fail issue. They're still too big to fail, right?
Well, they're bigger than they were actually before September 2008. The ones that survived made it out bigger thanks to sort of the shotgun marriages that the Fed and the Treasury orchestrated. And what was interesting about the effort to break up the giant banks was, and by the way, we think this is the most important thing to do to try to deal with, to reduce Wall Street's overweening power in the economy and in the political system as well. We and some others have been out there talking about this problem. It was hardly any great insight that it was a problem. But a lot of the conventional wisdom in Washington, even in liberal circles, was that it was something that anybody could do about it. It was clear that the explicit position of the administration was, well, even if you think it's a problem, these giant institutions are fait accompli. You cannot undo what's already been done. There's also this sort of a nonsensical line that we need these giant banks because there's giant banks elsewhere and we can't be competitive unless we have these colossal institutions. And that was the prevailing view through the House consideration of the financial re-regulation bill. And there was only a nod to the too big to fail issue in the House bill, which not going to make much difference about anything. And then that seemed to be how things were. And then suddenly, as people got more engaged, and the Senate fight was a much more publicly engaged fight than the House fight had been, primarily because we were done with health care. As the public got more engaged on the Senate side, and as groups really picked up their efforts, we did have a serious fight over too big to fail. Senators Brown and Kaufman proposed an amendment that would have required the shrinking of the six dominant banks. And as the bill was starting to move forward and votes were starting to be had, momentum was really moving behind the Brown-Kaufman amendment. And the Chairman Dodd refused, and the leader of the Senate, Harry Reid, refused, as the bill was on the floor, to schedule a vote on this amendment. But the momentum was building and building, and then suddenly they called a snap vote. And we lost 33-61, but those 33 votes were far more than people would have considered possible 2 or 3 months before. They would have guessed 2 or 3 votes. And there's at least one unnamed source from the White House that was quoted as saying, had we been for that provision, it would have prevailed. So there's actually, we were able to get that thing in play, and it was taken seriously, and we had a real fight on it. And I think, it was not a very different set of decisions, we would have won. And that's quite something, and it gives us some hope for possibly revisiting this in the near future. future.
Yeah, we've only got a minute or so left, but I did want to get to this point that some people say this is like a good place to start. Now we have to fix things even more. I don't know. It seems hard to believe that people, after the kind of fight that produced this, that people will want to come back and revisit this territory anytime soon. But do you think there's any possibility of making this thing better in the near future?
Yeah, I do. I mean, there's two parts to it. One is that because so much is up for grabs in the regulatory process, if things go right, a lot of really good things can be done. But as I said, my presumption is that all those things are going to go wrong. We're going to try not to come out that way. Hopefully we can make some difference. The other piece is we have to go back to Congress. And you're exactly right. It's going to be hard. It feels finished right now. On the other hand, you started out the discussion by saying, how does this compare to the 1930s? And one thing that happened in the 1930s was they didn't do it all at once. There were a whole series of rounds of financial regulation. And that's what we're going to need to do this time, too, to respond to a crisis that was almost as large.
All right. Well, good luck in fighting a good fight, Rob.
Thanks, Dick.
I've been speaking with Rob Weissman, who is the president of Public Citizen and a guy and an organization that do lots of great work. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. And let's go out with this a little bit from the new album by Sleigh Bells. This one's called Real Real. Till next week. Bye.